Thank you, and I want to thank everybody for coming again for the third presentation to learn about my fascination with John McGraw, who's not far from the center of this. And also, one of the things that makes me proud of being a part of SABR is the light that we shed on different subjects. And this is the third presentation in this room this afternoon that's trying to do so. So basically, the story I want to talk about is one of the best-kept secrets of the game. And Wilbert Robinson, who became the famous and beloved manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, they became known as the Robins, took over in 1914. He left the Giants, where he was John McGraw's coach. And we've later learned that they had a huge falling out and a huge fight and didn't speak to each other. And what struck me about a year ago is, with all the microfilm work that I do of the teams in the 20s, I never came across even an iota, a shred of a hint of evidence that there was a falling out. They were always beloved best buddies, and to make matters even more confusing, each of them said how much he was friendly with the other guy. And it got to the point that even for a while, I was wondering if this was a baseball myth that they had a fight. But let's take a look at it, and I'm going to go through some things about what really happened with these men. Going back a long time, McGraw on the left and Robinson on the right here were teammates on the great Baltimore Orioles of the 1890s. And Robinson was really McGraw's what was called by one Brooklyn sports writer, soft soap artist. And Tommy Holmes once wrote that whenever an umpire was about to throw McGraw out of the game, Robbie would come out there jovially and say, and I'm quoting here, "Come on, Hank, you know he don't mean it, he's just excited." And Hank may very well be Hank O'Day, who became an umpire when they were still on the Orioles together. And eventually, of course, John McGraw ended up in New York in 1902, taking over the Giants. Robbie did not follow him because the two of them were not only close friends, but they were business partners with the Blue Diamond Cafe. I think it had a bowling alley and a pool hall also. And he stayed behind in Baltimore while McGraw did good things in New York. And Damon Runyon, whenever I find his stuff, I love. I'm not going to read these quotes. Hopefully, if the people in the back of the room can read them, if you can't, raise your hands. But I figure I can go a little bit more material by letting you read them. Damon Runyon here, and I see the bottom is a little just his name cut off, described both Robbie and McGraw in 1913 when Robbie left the Giants. And there were no more different men you could imagine. Here's the dictator, the autocrat, McGraw in the teens. And here's Wilbur Robinson, who's really much more of an easygoing, almost like may remind you of an old uncle that you had many years ago. Robbie came back to baseball in 1903, 1904. He joined the Baltimore Orioles of the International League for Jack Dunn. He even played with him. He played with him as late as 1908, appearing in 30 games at the age of 44. I hadn't known that before. And then he decided to join McGraw in spring training of 1909, 1910, and 1911. He didn't want to really hang out with the team all year long. And they became, later on we'll talk about when he joined them full time. But those 3 years, he left them after spring training, 1909, 1910, and 1911. Late in the 1911 season, when Robbie was back in Baltimore, he got a telegram from the Giants. They had been leading almost the entire season. They went in a tailspin in August. They really got tightened up. You can imagine John McGraw probably wasn't a very pleasant guy to be around when the team's in a losing streak. The Cubs took over first place on August the 20th, and Robbie got this telegram to come. And even McGraw acknowledges what he did. Robbie bought beer for the players. He bought clothes for some of them. He held a pool tournament. And before too long, in McGraw's words, in my 30 years in baseball, the psychological effect was wonderful. In a little while, the young fellows relaxed and became natural again. The Giants won 34 of their last 46 games. They won the pennant, going away by 7.5 games. And Robbie really had a way of coaxing amazing things out of pitchers. And in 1911, 12, and 13, each year he had a pitcher that he had taken under his wings and who did some fantastic things. He spent a lot of time in 1911 with Marquardt in spring training, even before he came back. And Marquardt had been sort of a washout, a big expensive ball player that was a bust. And around this time then, McGraw joined the team, and then he came back for 1912 and 1913 full-time. And the writers loved him. There's no question that they did love him. And McGraw loved getting a lot of the attention. And he didn't take too kindly, I think, to the fact that all of a sudden Robbie was getting that attention. And I know it's hard to measure the effectiveness of managers, let alone pitching coaches, but I would suggest to you that about 100 years ago, this was a man that had a profound different impact on his pitching staff. Here's what he was with the team 1911 through 1913. He left the team then to go to Brooklyn, and it's something we hear about it nowadays. I would even suggest that a half century after this, maybe guys like Mel Harder and Johnny Sane, if you really start looking at pitchers and how they did before and after they were the pitching coach, something to think about. And they certainly had a great pitching staff during those 3 years. The Giants won the National League pennant all 3 years, 11, 12, and 13. They had a falling out after the 1913 season. McGraw lost his third World Series in a row, and in a famous party at a bar after the 1913 series, they got into an argument. McGraw said, "Get the hell out of here, this is my party." And Robbie left, but not before he poured his beer on McGraw's head. And they either never talked again or didn't talk again for a very, very long time. And McGraw, just as an aside, accused Robbie of missing a sign. And it actually went back not in the World Series. It started earlier in the season when Robbie thought McGraw wanted an injured Fred Snodgrass to steal. Snodgrass was thrown out by 20 feet. And later on, Robbie once said it was just a misunderstanding. But for McGraw to think I would send down a runner in his condition on my own was an insult to my intelligence. Lee Allen quoted that. And let's take a look at the story of the falling out. Again, it was never mentioned in the teams in the 20s. When retired umpire Bill Clem wrote a famous series with a sports writer in Collier's magazine in 1951, the story of this fight and falling out emerged. And actually, Clem was not the first one to break the best-kept secret. Frank Graham, when he wrote his histories of the Giants, the Dodgers, and even McGraw's biography, had already told that story. But I think that Clem, probably Collier's, had a much bigger circulation than the books of Frank Graham. So a lot of people say, well, Clem revealed it. But it was really Graham started talking about it and saying that they were hardly on speaking terms even going into the 1913 World Series. Now, I wanted to put together a little timeline here. The World Series where the Giants lose to the A's ends, and right after that, John McGraw is preparing for the World Tour that we heard about from Dan Levitt yesterday. And they left heading west, playing exhibition games on their way to the West Coast. Robbie was released by the Giants on October 30th. He claims that he asked to be released. His family was objecting to his traveling, and who knows, if he hadn't been hired by the Robins, you know, maybe McGraw would have, there would have been a forgive and forget, and maybe he would have been back. He felt that McGraw expected him to show up the next year, and when he was released, Sam Crane, the former ball player and now sports writer, said that they really need him, and he hopes that Robbie will, you know, get the bug and want to come back again in the spring of 1914. There were reports that Robbie was going to do other stuff, including buying the Federal League team. And Bill Dolan, who was the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, was fired in mid-November. The next day, while John McGraw was on a train heading up to Southern Oregon, Robbie was hired. The thing that we don't know is exactly when Robbie was signed. What we do know is that Charlie Ebbets, the owner of the Dodgers, hated John McGraw. They had a falling out back in 1905, and Robbie loved to stick it to him. Graham said in his history of the Dodgers, any success that McGraw achieved was a gall to Charlie. And it's very possible that he could have heard about the big fight there and signed Wilbur Robinson very quickly after the World Series, possibly thinking he may be a coach, but he wanted to get Robbie away from the Giants. And just moving along here, we know when he was hired as manager. We don't know quite when he was actually signed. Now, the public story, and I like to go to as many newspapers as I can. When Robinson was hired by the Dodgers, and Bill Dolan had not done real well with the Robins, I think that Ebbets liked Dolan, but I think the fans were on Dolan's case for not delivering a winner. the newspapers had these stories, and sometimes when you hear somebody denying something too vehemently, too often, maybe there's some truth to it. But the stories range from the fact that they were buddies, that McGraw's going to miss him, to the fact that McGraw was the key to getting him signed, that maybe McGraw, while he was on the train to Northern California, was telegraphing his enemy, Evans, recommending that he hire Robinson. But this is just a sampling. I'm going to fill up another slide or two of what that public story was, and that these guys were good pals. What was really going on? Well, the biography of Wilbur Robinson by Norman Mock, who was here an hour ago, and Jack Cavanaugh, and I quote, says, "Robinson would always relish a ball-filled victory when McGraw was his adversary, and some seasons to come beating the Giants would make up for a losing year." That's in their book, Uncle Robbie. And Frank Graham, on the other side, observed that McGraw was privately scornful of Robinson. But whenever they talked, you think that they were good friends. Now, here is what Frank Graham said many years later when he started writing his books in the 1940s, his Putnam team histories. Bill McGeehan, the well-known sports writer, columnist for the Herald Tribune, wrote that in 1930. That's really the earliest. I never found anything in the 20s. Or the teams talking about this big fight. And it's interesting to note, I just recently was working on 1927 when John McGraw had his 25th anniversary being the Giant at the Polo Grounds. It was an elaborate ceremony, and the newspapers had the list of all the old Orioles that were there. Conspicuous in his absence was Wilbur Robinson. I went to the schedule. The Robins, as they were then called, were in the middle of a two-week homestand. So it wasn't that Robinson was traveling somewhere out of town. He was in town. Apparently, he was not there. And this was the only hint that I had that something might have been up between the two men, that they really had this fight. And it was in not even a major Brooklyn paper, in the Brooklyn Times, and it didn't go any further than that. That's all it really said. And after Robbie was signed, he added to it, one of the things that he said the day after he was signed, he said, "I'm going to use McGraw tactics entirely. He's the best man in the business. I'm going to follow him." And John McGraw made this comment in 1916 when Robbie surprisingly led the Brooklyn to the pennant. "If I can't win the pennant, nobody except my buddy Wilbur Robinson can do it." And apparently, these guys had become fierce enemies. They were not even talking to each other. And I think that people probably understood that right away Robbie was going to, and he did, set a very different tone at spring training camp. Things were a lot more relaxed than they were under McGraw. But one of the things I want to throw out, and I'm going to sort of throw a side question here, and I don't even think it has to do with baseball, but even in the business world in general, when you have a very talented, autocratic guy on the top, it oftentimes may help to have somebody in between that can be a buffer between them. And isn't it interesting that the Giants won the pennant in 1911 through 1913 with Robbie sort of shielding the more sensitive guys some of the pitchers like Marquardt, and then he leaves, and between 1914 and until 1921, they only won one pennant, and during that time, they're even able to legally raid other National League teams because McGraw would say, well, they would have jumped to the Federal League, so he got talent like Ferdy Shupp and Sally. Look at the 1920s then. Huey Jennings comes over to the Giants, and all of a sudden, they win four pennants. Now, there's much more to that. Jennings leaves, it's not as good. Roger Bresnahan came in, but Bresnahan's not a kind of guy like Robbie or Jennings. He's much more like McGraw. That's just an aside. Wilbur Robinson did have an impact on this team. And I don't know if we have any people that live in Brooklyn here. I know we have some that are from Brooklyn, but Brooklyn fell in love with Wilbur Robinson. They were crazy about him. And this is one more comment that I used in a slide last year at the Sabre Convention. And McGraw's going to great lengths to say, not only did he love Robbie, but he helped him get the job. And, I miss him. And interesting story. And then this stuff comes out years later. Andrew Goldblatt in his McFarland book about the rivalry of the two teams says it about as well as I could possibly say it. Everybody knew that Robbie was about as different from McGraw as could be, and that's the way he ran his team that took the name after him, the Robins. So they loved him there, and here's a statement from a prominent sports writer, Joe Williams. People were crazy about Robbie. They were crazy about baseball, or maybe people in Brooklyn are just crazy. And threw that in there. Now, Rube Marquardt, without Robbie there, his career went to hell. And in Larry Ritter's Glory of Their Times, he says what McGraw said to him, no one's going to take you. He actually got Robbie to convince Evans to pick him up. McGraw released him, and he was sensational when they turned him around, and he says how Robbie treated him. And Robbie really just resurrected Rube Marquardt's career, and they won the 1916 pennant. When the Giants were losing those three World Series in a row, and then they were not good in 1914 and 1915, McGraw started taking it out on one of the stars, on Marquardt. And I just throw this up here. More than a decade later, when McGraw started not winning pennants anymore in 1925 and 1926, one of his very best players, he started berating to the point that Frankie Frisch walked out on the team and was soon traded. So again, I just wonder whether there's some connections. I'm not giving all the answers here, throwing things out. So I think in conclusion, what I really wanted to throw out here is, if indeed these guys had this falling out, and apparently they did, what was it all about? Why did they hide it? And I think the answer ultimately is not a huge baseball mystery. It may be more of human nature, and some of the people in this room have helped me understand the answer. And maybe you can think about it yourself. If you had a friend, and you had a lot of mutual friends, and you had a falling out with your friend, it may not have served anything for you to let all those other people know that you had a big fight with them, especially if the other guy was like Wilbur Robinson, the most well-loved guy in the game. So you just sort of let it go. And John McGraw, as tough a character as he was, and we covered it, Lyle and I, in our 1921 book, he would give jobs. He would take care of former Giant and Oriole players. In 21 alone, we have Jennings, Dolan, Jesse Burkett, Bill Dahlin, Art Devlin, Amos Roussey, brothers, and even James Mutry. He gave a job to the former manager from the 1880s of the Giants. So McGraw sort of must have liked the fact that he had this sort of reputation for helping people out. And, you know, Uncle Robbie became beloved. I showed that picture last year. It's one of my favorite ones. And I don't know if there's ever been a character quite like it. Maybe Casey Stengel, maybe others come to your mind. Dazzy Vance, I'm not sure how many of you know, was on the Yankees repeatedly in the teens. He didn't win a game, whether his arm came back, but Robbie and Bill Corum called Vance his masterpiece. That was the crowning achievement of Wilbur Robinson's career, what he was able to do there, and act as a buffer. And the team, of course, won the 1920 pennant also. And, one closing quote here is from Frank Graham from his book. And I just think it happens. People get falling out. I know I came across a Westbrook Pegler quote about, and Pegler was a pretty tough guy himself, where he said that it is a favorite fallacy that old people grow mellow and forgiving, which is definitely not always the case. And ironically, as different as these two men were, they really, I would suggest that in the closing, had something very strongly in common. When Robbie came to the Dodgers, that was sort of amusing, because after his first comment with the press, Evans was so excited he pounded on the table and he said, "By George, we've got a real manager this time," which was a little puzzling to me because he really liked Bill Dahlin and respected him, and that seemed like, I think he just sort of said it emotionally. He was so excited that the press seemed to click with Robbie that he made that comment. But the very first day, in the first days, all that Robbie could talk about was the fact, I had to get out of their minds that they're a second division team. And if you study the Dodgers that won the pennant in 16 and 20 and almost won it in 24, he made these guys believe that they were better than they were. And John McGraw, I think, you know, did that also. You know, when Larry Doyle made the comment, I think in 1911, Damon Runyon, "It's great to be young and a Giant," I mean, John McGraw made being a Giant something very special, and they've made the players even play better than they normally would have been capable of. Damon Runyon said back in, I think, 1913, to be in John McGraw's league and of his Giants was, in McGraw's mind, the highest honor that could befall a man. And I think when Wilbur Robinson went over to the Robins, he did bring that over, that the players had to believe in themselves. Rube Marcar was no good if he didn't believe in himself. But when he did, and he started winning again. Thank you, and Rick.
Yes, Steve. Did you find, from 1914 onwards, they're managing against each other, 22 times a year, approximately 400 games, and the managers would typically meet before the game with the umpires. Did you find any evidence of any...
I did not, and I have to admit that I didn't study that in particular, and my focus tends to be more in microfilm on the American League than the National League, because it's a Yankees interest, but I really didn't. But there was one quote there, I think, from Graham that says when they were sort of civil when they met with each other, but just barely civil, but I never found anything. It was just, it was so well hidden, so I did not.
Thanks.
David?
When Robbie and McGraw played for the Baltimore Orioles in the 90s, they bought several billiard parlors, partners in Baltimore. And I think when McGraw went on to New York, they still kept him at least for a few years. And another thing I wanted to ask you was, when did the term Dodgers come? Did it come after Robbie died or after he left the Dodgers?
Well, I think it came earlier, but I would ask Lyle here to answer that better than I possibly could, because I think they were referred to as the Dodgers. I'm giving you the question.
And some newspapers continued to call them depending on their relationship with Robbie.
Yeah, Joe Ville and the New York Sun had a huge falling out, I think, with Robbie, and he never mentioned his name and would always call them the Dodgers, even during that time.
How long did he manage and before he replaced them?
Well, that's a great point, and I have a lot of material, and maybe I'll write it as an article. He managed through 1931, and there's a number of more recent books that say they made up in the 1930 winter meetings. And I went back to the 1930 microfilm and did a big look, and I never found that story. Not only did I not find that story, but that was the first year in more than a decade that Robbie did not attend the winter meetings because of political infighting going on with McKeever. And there was a lot of talk about, boy, these are not like other winter meetings. Something is missing here. And Ray Robinson, I know he's not contemporary, in his biography of baseball's greatest manager, said they never spoke again, ever. So if they did make up, I didn't find it. I may have missed it. And then after him was Max Carey, I believe. And then Casey Stengel, Burley Grimes. They had a decade of losing.
You might have mentioned this in your talk. Because they were, this dispute was so kept quiet.
Hush, hush.
How did you stumble across it then?
Well, just as a baseball researcher, it's a given that these guys, when you read baseball history, that they had this huge fight. And what hit me was, I never saw word of it in the microfilm. So was that a myth? And I tend to think that Frank Graham was a heck of a good reporter when he mentioned it, and then you find these other little things, and somebody like McGeehan is as good as they get. They did have a fight, but it was a secret.
Didn't the Dodgers play very well against the Giants during that era, especially compared to their overall record?
I'm not qualified. I didn't study that per se, and that would be a good question to do. You got a feeling that his satisfaction of beating they could have a terrible team, and beating the Giants for them was like going to the series.
I think I remember seeing it somewhere online that their record head-to-head was much better than it should have been on the Dodgers side based on the team's overall record.
Could very well be. John?
Yeah.
pocket.
As I've researched the giant Dodge Arrival thing, a lot of people say that that really, really began the hatred between the two teams when Bill Terry said the Dodge is a dead. Now it's in the 30s.
Yeah, it's
still in the league.
Yeah, and then they lost two games and the pennant and Casey. Right. Yeah,
what was the rivalry?
It went far earlier than that, and I'm not sure. It sticks in my mind what the Evitz McGraw thing was like with Barney Dreyfus, whether McGraw called him a name and then Evitz and McGraw just hated each other, and it went far before the Bill Terry thing. And there was always a thing, obviously, of people that live in Manhattan, or probably even the Queens or the Bronx. They look down on Brooklyn. Brooklyn's part of New York, but it really isn't part of New York. And that's where one of my favorite stories, I don't know if it's apocryphal, and I'll close with that, is that they talk about a fan. You know, when Robbie would drive home, people would stop him in traffic and say, "Why'd you walk that guy in the seventh inning?" Or, "Why'd you take that pitcher out?" And he would talk to people, you know, on his way home. But there was one fan leaving a game, and he had to leave early. And another guy on the street says, "What's going on?" And he said, "The Giants have three men on base." And the guy said, "Which base?" And that's the end of my... That may not be true.